Hello and welcome to another episode of Greater Perspectives. This week we have Greg Lukianov from FIRE. He is an amazing free speech advocate, lawyer, and really an expert on the topic. And we're super excited to have you here today. What is it that you guys are doing over at FIRE for those who aren't familiar? I know I recently read a piece and I shared it on my social media platforms about your ranking of college campuses all over the United States. Tell us more about what you do.
I'm a constitutional lawyer specializing in the First Amendment. I started as FIRE's legal director, and then I became president in 2006. And in 2022, we changed our name from the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education to the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, because we wanted to signal the fact that we were extending beyond just campus work. And it's been nonstop craziness since then. The ranking, interestingly, is something that we started in 2019, and it's partially one of the reasons why we felt like we could expand off campus. And what I mean by that is, for almost all of FIRE's history, people were asking us to, okay, you focus on campus, can you expand beyond that? And my answer is always, well, honestly, a lot of the most important free speech fights are being battled on campus, and they're the people who educate our future lawyers and our future politicians. And so it really is important to win that battle on campus.
But by win that battle, you mean specifically ensuring that free speech discussion and debate thrives?
Yeah. Win that battle for freedom of speech and for academic freedom. We were founded in 1999 to defend freedom of speech on campus, and then we expanded beyond it in 2022. So sorry if I missed that. The ranking was something that we started doing in a sort of primitive form in 2019, and we started with 50 schools, and we would it was based on the largest survey of student opinion ever conducted at the time to figure out what campuses actually had students who said the atmosphere for disagreeing with your professors, for disagreeing with your students is good. That had a low percentage of students who said, in fact, violence is justifiable in response to freedom of speech and shout downs are okay. So, obviously if you have a high level of people saying, oh, that's fine, when it comes to violence in response to free speech, that's a negative. But if you have a high level of people saying, I don't worry at all about disagreeing with my professors, that's a positive. But as the years have gone by, we've been able to improve and improve upon and expand the way we do the campus free speech ranking. Harvard ranked dead last on our ranking this year. It was funny to hear them, say that to immediately assume our methodology was flawed or that it was some kind of stunt, giving me the opportunity to talk to the entire Wall Street Journal audience saying, well, it's based on the largest study of student opinion ever conducted, plus the largest database of student cancellations, professor cancellations, campus speech codes, and deplatforming ever assembled. And not only did Harvard score dead last, it got our first ever negative score.
Okay. How do you get a negative score?
By, first of all, you do poorly on the poll part, where basically, high levels of students think violence in response to speech is not so bad. And not well on the tolerance part, where people feel like they can't really disagree with each other. So if you punish professors for speech, then that's a ding. You get a negative score for that. If you deplatform speakers when students demand that you do or administrators demand that you do, you get a negative for that. You get a positive if you stand up to them.
It's the real world version of, are you banning people?
there's a fair amount of that. And also, do your policies protect freedom of speech? So we factor those all together, and Harvard scored a negative 10.69, which we rounded up to zero. And it was a good chunk even then below University of Pennsylvania, which was second to last. Right above University of Pennsylvania was University of South Carolina, which was which hasn't been doing a great job. And then right above that, in fourth to last place, was Georgetown. Meanwhile, schools like Michigan Technological University finished first. Auburn did really well. University of Virginia finished in the top 10. And University of Chicago was 13th in the nation. But the Ivy League schools did terribly.
Which is really interesting, because actually everyone loves the takeaway of, wow, what are the worst offenders? But actually, I think the more important takeaway of all this is actually, where would you want to study if you were in pursuit of intellectual freedom and, you know, knowledge?
Yeah. Well, and that's one of the things we're trying to do with the Campus Free Speech Ranking, is encourage people to reward the schools that are good on free speech and to encourage them not to apply, or let, or certainly not donate to some of the schools that are terrible. And of course, like I say donate with such disdain, because it's kind of like, you know, you shop at Walmart, you don't really feel additionally compelled to just like send them money for no good reason. And when you look at some of these, you know, the Harvards and my alma mater, Stanford and Princeton, like they're perpetual motion machines when it comes to like how much money they have in the bank. And the idea that we still have, you know, a billionaire, a millionaire class who sends tremendous amounts of money to these schools, it's
oh yeah,
it's weird.
Especially if they're reinforcing the idea that the First Amendment isn't as important as it should be, whether they say it or not, right? It doesn't matter what they say. If they're taking action that hurts the First Amendment and people's rights to free speech, doesn't really matter if they're saying they support it. They don't, right?
Well, unfortunately, that has also been a change. It used to be the very normal thing when it comes to freedom of speech is that people say that they, you know, they love freedom of speech, but they disagree with it on like, you know, one or two cases or like whatever. But one thing that we could see coming in our 25-year history was that there was a movement afoot to get more people saying, actually, I disagree with free speech as a concept. I philosophically disagree with freedom of speech. And we see a lot more of that today than we did earlier in my career. But we definitely saw that trend coming.
This brings up an interesting point, right? So in your book, Canceling of the American Mind, which you've released recently, great book, by the way. I had a lot of notes from it. You know, you brought up a few points that I think is really interesting. One of them being the university slash like education industry as a whole in the United States, the education industry is not this small, weak, you know, you know, underfunded entity that it pretends to be. It's in fact the largest, I think it was $1.4 trillion in revenue annually. And if you were to combine the gross revenue of Apple, Google, Facebook, and the entire electricity expenditures of all people in the United States together, it's still smaller and pales in comparison to the amount of income that the education industry brings in annually.
Yeah.
And I think you'd mentioned in the book that one of the reasons why that's so important is when people are the elite class, and there doesn't get more elite than the most massive industry in the country, they feel the need to control the narrative and control speech.
Yeah. Yeah. And that whole section, you know, where we explain how massive and wealthy, you know, the higher education juggernaut in the United States is really needed to be in there, because you can talk to people at sometimes at these schools, you know, that are sitting on, I don't know, $50 billion in their rainy day fund. And they talk as if they are the
$50 billion. Like, how many boats are we going to be able to buy with that? Only a few yachts and private jets. And
yeah. they talk sometimes like they're the underdogs or representatives of the, I was so amazed watching someone defending Harvard, accusing its critics of not wanting to be involved with the hoi polloi. And I'm kind of like, wow, you guys are really out of touch, because
what's a hoi polloi? What's
that? Hoi polloi means regular people. It, as my British mom would explain, it's hoi polloi, you know, basically like people who are regular folk. And it was basically trying to more or less commandeer the, I guess, Harvard as being the favorite little guy. And it's like, are you out of your minds? It is the definition of the man.
Yeah. And they're training the next generation of the man, if you will, to with their ideological bend. At least that's how it feels. I don't know if I can necessarily prove that, but it certainly feels that.
Oh, no. That's entirely fair. One of the reasons why, when people actually say, you know, oh, but you focus so much on Harvard and the elite colleges. Now, of course, I get annoyed at that because I spent a lot of my career defending people at schools that aren't all that well known, and was told, oh, nobody's going to care about this because it's not Harvard and it's not Yale. Mm-hmm. And then when we actually do take on Harvard and Yale, they say, oh, but nobody, those schools don't, you know, those aren't the schools most people go to. And mm-hmm. particularly when it comes to Harvard and Yale, I'm like, okay, those are two schools that are more important than they should be. Mm-hmm. And nobody believes that more than I do, but they are incredibly important. Every single member mm-hmm. of the Supreme Court either attended Harvard or Yale at some point. When it comes to, when you look at our political leadership in the country, wildly disproportionately Ivy League, Harvard and Yale, Stanford, Duke, a couple others. We are unfortunately dominated by elite institutions. I think it's unhealthy. I wish it wasn't mm-hmm. the case. But as long as it is, we have to care more about these schools. And these schools are uniquely dysfunctional.
And so if these schools are the ones that are predominantly making up our elite kind of leaders, if you will, around the country, they also have an ideological bias and are not respecting people's rights to free speech and challenge on their campuses. What does that say about the potential tolerance of some of the founding values of our country, freedom of speech, expression, rights of discussion, debate? What does that say about their tolerance and how they're prepared to then be our leaders around the country?
Well, everyone should be really worried about this, because when you have, you know, to go back to Stanford Law School, I was really horrified earlier this year, and that we devote an entire chapter of canceling of the American mind, of using it as a case study that shows almost everything that's wrong with higher ed today in a single incident. It was the, you know, about a fifth of the law school class, in coordination with administrators, coming to shout down a Fifth Circuit judge named Kyle Duncan. He was a Trump appointee. And they shouted him down for 10 minutes when he tried to speak to the Federalist Society. Then an administrator gets up and reads a prepared speech for 7 minutes, questioning whether or not the juice of free speech was worth the squeeze of the pain free speech causes. Mm-hmm. And then followed just by, you know, nonstop heckling of the judge. And it's just a perfect example of kind of all the problems of the way we argue. And to have one fifth of the class show up and show such little understanding of the, you know, right to listen, the free speech rights of mm-hmm. the Federalist Society to invite who they'd like to hear, mm-hmm. Should scare everyone to death, because these are the likely, not that I'm sure that they should be, but these are going to be the people who dominate the courts in the future and dominate the profession.
Yeah. And courts aside, I think we can also see in our society, there's a general lack of tolerance for people with difference in opinion. Sorry. Made that more complicated than it needed to be. But and so you're seeing that when more tactics are around, you know, speech is violence is apparently a lot of phrases that I hear getting thrown around a lot. And, you know, the idea that saying certain things can hurt people and somehow emotional pain is therefore justifies any kind of other action. And I think, you know, from my perspective, people have the right also not to listen. You don't have to know, you know, you don't have to debate.
Well, you also have the right not to attend a speech and to let other people attend a speech. The past couple of weeks at FIRE, we've seen a huge number of shout downs on campus, including at Berkeley, including at, there was one at Yale. There was another one at, I think, Irvine. There was one at Puget Sound. There was one.
Is a shout down per your definition?
A shout down means that you know, shouting so that someone can't speak. And at Berkeley, it was actually even worse. It was outright violent. The students got together in order to, in their own words, all caps. It's nice to have them actually say the motive, you know, in writing, to shut it down. And it was an IDF soldier speaking about the conflict in the Israel-Hamas conflict. And they swarmed the venue at Berkeley. They smashed windows and filtered in and led to the evacuation of the speaker there. There was violence. People were assaulted. Mm-hmm. And you know, to us, you know, that's obviously mob censorship. I think any thinking person, that is a heckler's veto. And you still deal with on social media, people being like, well, it's just their free speech rights to shout them down and engage in violence.
That's a real like overstep, right? Like, and that's the crazy thing. And that's also the amazing thing about free speech is you can justify and make a case for about anything. Mm-hmm. And for those people who are struggling to make a good case, whatever they can come up with to censor it then becomes the default position. Ad hominem, attack the person's credibility, just shout them down or scare people from even entering the building if you can, right?
Yeah. Well, but you don't have a right to engage in violence. You don't have a right to engage in threats. You don't have a right to prevent other people from attending a speech. And it's funny watching people try to make this argument with a straight face because they're just people who are used to being the dominant popular force on campus. Like they're people who kind of assume the mob is naturally on their side.
Well, if they get the most likes and clicks on Twitter and Facebook with their ridiculous position, they feel confident, right?
And as soon as it's actually a speaker they liked and that that happened to, they would they would immediately say, oh, a bunch of fascists showed up and shouted down our speakers and resorted to violence. And it's like, yeah, you'd get it if it was someone you liked, just that doesn't happen as often.
Yeah, well, exactly. And that's why you have those protections. It's because you may not be correct. And that's something I think people struggle with is this idea that I might be wrong with my opinion. Therefore, I should let somebody share theirs, especially if it differs from mine, because maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. We should listen to it, argue it, debate it, and have that conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at the heart of freedom of speech is epistemic humility. You know, the knowledge that in the grand scheme of things, not only do you not know everything, you can't.
If we go back to your book, Canceling the American Mind, one of the points that you'd mentioned is that in all of the like communist Red Scare eras, there were not as many average like daily or yearly cancelings of professors for what they believe as there are today.
Yeah.
And now it's an unprecedented and scary amount of professors that are losing their jobs.
Yeah. People, you know, have really exploded at that part. And every time they've reacted to it, like, well, that's just hyperbole. And I'm like, okay, well, actually there are numbers on this.
Use the data, right?
Yeah. And so the Red Scare is generally the second Red Scare, which is McCarthyism. Mm-hmm. The first Red Scare is much shorter and it was in the 1919 and 1921. Mm-hmm. The second Red Scare, which is basically considered to be 1947 to 1957 and 1957, because the law was established protecting academic freedom in 57. So prior to that, people, you know, university presidents were like, well, sure, I can fire communist professors. They're too doctrinaire. They're not. And that was the rationale they used. They're not capable of spouting anything other than ideology. And a lot of university presidents thought they could do that even at public colleges. And the best study of McCarthyism at the time indicated that about 62 professors were fired for either being communists or saying they were communists. And about 100 roughly overall were fired for political opinion writ large. Now, some of them we don't know exactly what political opinion. But when we looked at the numbers for the, you know, 9 and a half years of cancel culture, which we defined as starting beginning in 2014, you know, we find that it's almost 200. So it's like literally twice as many that we know of. And when you look at schools like Harvard, when you look at schools that were around and also some of the most influential schools in the country, there were basically no professors fired. Or at least, you know, very small numbers of professors fired at a lot of these elite private schools. And those are the ones that dominate the charts now. And I think there is something to be said for the fact that it's a little scarier when some of the calls are coming from inside the building, that essentially it's the professors and students and administrators who are in many cases demanding that other professors lose their jobs over their opinion. By the way, in an environment that there are there's almost no viewpoint diversity at these schools to begin with. So you're talking about incredibly homogenous schools to begin with. Yeah. There's the whole conformity gauntlet, which we talk about in the book as being conformity inducing pressures at every level to kind of prevent these incidents from happening in the first place. And the law is supposed to be protecting them now, unlike during the McCarthyism. And there's still nearly twice as many professors losing their jobs. And they'll probably, there almost certainly will be more once you actually compare the 11 years of cancel culture to the 11 years of McCarthyism. And when you look at the post-1973 campus, there is nothing even vaguely like the situation we've seen over the last 10 years. And again, under a circumstance of very low levels of viewpoint diversity. So a better comparison would be, you know, post-9/11 / Iraq war. How many professors lost their job then when the law is clearly established? And, you know, we looked into it and we have this incredible database. We found about 15 attempts to get professors punished, with about 3 fired. And all 3 of those were fired for reasons that actually didn't seriously implicate the First Amendment. And meanwhile, you're talking about cases.
What would be an example of that? Sorry. What would not seriously implicate the First Amendment?
Samuel Aryan was one of the first cases that we fought at FIRE that was like big and well known. This is a guy who Bill O'Reilly signaled him out after 9/11 for having ties to terrorism, actually ties to Islamic Jihad, to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And University of South Florida, which had previously done an investigation of Samuel Aryan and decided, you know, oh, no, these aren't serious allegations, didn't want to say, OK, maybe actually there was something more to those than we did in that investigation a couple of years ago. So they decided instead to fire Samuel Aryan for saying death to Israel in a video from 1989. And as soon as it was a video, and as soon as it was him actually saying something that they were justifying the firing based on, it was a fire case. And we were like, okay. And that's actually where the secret motto of FIRE comes from, because there were 6 of us back then and we had no money. And we had this incredibly unsympathetic case. We all kind of looked at each other like, oh, this might destroy the organization. And the secret motto of FIRE is, we'll run this bus into a wall rather than be unprincipled. And if this is what brings us down, this is what brings us down. But we're still going to do it. And so we defended Samuel Aryan and we defended his free speech rights. Eventually, he was indicted for having ties to the Muslim
Brotherhood. At that point, you probably bailed on the case, I presume, or at least.
We would say we bailed on the case because we made the point that, you know, they changed their argument. That it was no longer about speech. It was about him being indicted. And we're like, yeah, you can fire someone for being indicted for having ties to terrorism. Like that we understand. And so in that case, you know, they fired him for something that they absolutely legitimately can fire someone for that doesn't really seriously implicate First Amendment rights. So all 3 of those cases, none of them actually, all of them were justifiable for things that didn't actually implicate freedom of speech. Of the, you know, the 1,000 attempts to get professors fired over the last 9.5 years or coming at now 10 years, they've been overwhelmingly, you know, either jokes or people speaking, online, or worst of all, their research or their pedagogy, the stuff that tenure was designed to protect. And you're still talking about, you know, almost 50 tenured professors losing their jobs, which earlier in my career, I thought was impossible for a tenured professor to lose their job for their research.
Yeah, that was always the stereotype was, oh, once they reach tenure, there's nothing that can get them fired. Yeah. I remember hearing that a lot younger. And obviously that's not true, especially not now. That is quite fascinating. One thing that you had mentioned in the book was that there is an increase in, I'd say, kind of a lack of diversity at universities. As in, if people were to describe themselves as left, middle, or right, in the last, I'd say 20 years, I don't know, I don't have the book in front of me, that's gone from, you know, it was never one-to-one left and right, but it's definitely gotten so skewed left that it definitely could explain some of what we're seeing here.
Yeah. Well, no, the viewpoint diversity in the various departments has gone way down since the 1950s and 60s. And in the 1950s and 60s, the ratio of left to right among the professorate was roughly either by some estimates 2-to-1 or 3-to-1 left to right. Now you're talking about, you know, departments that have literally no conservatives in them whatsoever. And I think, it, you know, one study of Harvard that excluded a couple of departments, but included most of them, the ratio is something like 88-to-1. And that's a problem because the more
88-to-1 was a ratio.
Yeah.
For left to right.
And
okay. And so I'm sorry, I just have to cut in really quick. I think the claim that there is no bias at a university when your left to right ratio is 88-to-1, I think that goes out the window, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, it's silly to argue that there's no bias in higher education. And most people have stopped making, at least most serious people have stopped making that argument. Like anybody, like there was a time when people claimed, oh, there's not even that bad of a political tilt. And it's like, now people have moved on to, okay, it's really obvious there's a major political tilt, but it's justified. And people end up going to arguments like, oh, liberals are just smarter than conservatives. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, so your argument is just elitism.
Anybody you disagree with is stupid.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, the bias, particularly in elite higher education, is remarkable. Even in departments that people think of as being more conservative, like economics, mm-hmm. I still think the overall ratio at a lot of schools is still like 4-to-1. Mm-hmm. And this is a problem, and people have been sounding the alarm on this. There was definitely like earlier on, there was a lot more skittishness of saying so because it sounded like a partisan argument mm-hmm. by itself to make the point that there's a problem with having lack of viewpoint diversity. But when it comes to if your job is knowledge production, it's really important to have people who disagree with each other because the way you get at knowledge is by people disagreeing with each other.
Well, in universities, there's a large movement to have economic diversity, to have ethnic diversity, religious diversity. Why is there not to have political diversity? That's kind of shocking to me.
You know, my co-author of Coddling the American Mind, Jonathan Haidt, started up the Heterodox Academy, a nonprofit, in order to defend, you know, the idea of viewpoint diversity in higher ed. And you know, they've been able to gather supporters together. They've been able to, you know, make this argument more palatable to people who once might have dismissed it. But in terms of actually changing things, unfortunately, the lack of viewpoint diversity problem has only gotten worse in higher ed. And I don't honestly think that most of these institutions are serious about changing that. And that's one of the reasons why I think people take higher ed and the position of and a lot of the expert class less and less seriously over the years.
Yeah. Well, and I'm sorry, I'm just also just the first, like some of the things that come into my mind when you start explaining the numbers and all this, I start thinking, okay, why is it that these universities have started having this bias towards one ideological viewpoint? Is it like the chicken or the egg? And then I started thinking, oh, you know, I bet some conspiracy theorists would love to run with this. And you could even, you know, make the claim that they're just preparing for the, you know, the next generation of political class or whatever. They're trying to skew the game. And so like a lot of this stuff also could lead to conspiracy for like the people who are paranoid. Mm-hmm. And so this should be addressed because it definitely leaves a lot of people frustrated and confused. And I think, you know, tackling this issue would help the country, I believe.
Well, unfortunately, I think we probably need entirely new institutions. It's one of the reasons why University of Austin is something I have some hope for, which is a mm-hmm. experimental liberal arts university in Austin, trying to, you know, have a liberal arts college that is not a conservative college, that is just an old-fashioned liberal arts college starting from scratch. But I think we need 1,000 more experiments like that. I think we need small-scale institutions that consider their entire job to see if they can replicate the findings currently produced in higher education. And I think that one thing that happens when people actually sit down and do this, they find that awful lot of this stuff doesn't actually replicate. Some of it does. And of course, like that's great. And that advances knowledge. But the idea that you would have these hermetically sealed institutions that can only review their own stuff. And by the way, it also turns out that when you do any kind of fair science on them, it turns out that they're the biases that existed in it prevented a more effective knowledge producing producing product. That I think that people, you know, really start wondering, like, why is everyone going into huge debt to go to these institutions? Why are we massively federally funding them?
Yeah. I mean, that's a whole nother, you know, topic of discussion that I personally feel very passionate about, because I don't think that people should be going massively into debt to pay for these organizations.
Yeah.
And they're extremely wealthy, these organizations. So you're going, these poor people, you know, I'd say poor relative to about anybody who's working, you know, is the person who just graduated high school. They've got nothing to their name, and they start off with a $200,000 or $100,000 to $200,000 debt to their name. For what? To give the money to a university that is extremely wealthy? It makes little sense to me. For a lot of cases, I, you know, obviously not computer science or engineering or maybe physics, even, you know, law, anything, doctors, anything that requires, you know, an education of that caliber, I can understand it being an investment. But if the job doesn't pay off, at the end of the day, it doesn't make sense.
Well, and that's one of the things about public funding, is that public funding, you know, needs to make an argument for a public benefit. And I remember reading this book called Higher Education Question Mark by Claudia Dreyfus and Andrew Hacker, making the argument that there being a public benefit to education, like a liberal arts degree or higher ed, you know, it's like really more of a personal benefit. But they were trying to make an argument for a left-leaning argument for higher education as it currently exists, and the idea that they have to prove that there's a public benefit to it is silly. And it's kind of like, it's not silly if you're trying to actually prove why the public should be massively funding it. If you're saying the public shouldn't be massively funding it, they kind of like stumbled into an argument that I don't think they realized they were making.
Well, if you're receiving public funding for, I don't know, to say, you know, it is really important that we have a lot of history majors, or it is important that we have people learning some of these arts, you know, the funding should go to help people study that, because they know at the end of the day, a degree in those might not earn the person a return on investment comparable to those who are studying for something that's more of a high paying job. So it would be in the interest of the university in theory to help facilitate that. But instead, I think a lot of the people are paying a lot of the same kind of rates, and so it's hard to justify, like I said, it's hard to justify going into debt for something that's just not going to pay the bills at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And meanwhile, it seems like we did like the worst of both worlds. What we ended up doing was, instead of actually, you know, letting the free market work, or having a system by which we massively publicly fund higher ed, but then also say, oh, but, you know, don't go nuts. Don't, like, keep your costs under control. Don't massively bureaucratize, for example. And we chose neither. And we just decided to create a system that was guaranteed to lead to a massive expansion of the bureaucratic class. And as bad as some professors can be, and as good as, to be fair, some professors can be as well, the main problem in higher ed when it comes to professor and student cancellations is the administrative class. So, like, so much of that money has actually gone towards making the situation for both due process and free speech worse on campus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Well, that may be the kind of hinting towards the answer of our chicken and the egg question we had earlier. One thing that I've found online on social media now is it's nearly impossible to talk with people anymore. Yeah. At least on most mainstream platforms, that's a problem that I'm trying to tackle with Hedgehog. But that being said, there is the Israeli and Palestine conflict right now, and that has led to a lot of just heated, crazy discussions, not just online, offline, everywhere. You know, how do we protect discussions with that topic, and where do you draw the line of what is and is not acceptable to say?
Yeah. Well, it's one of those things where I'm going to give credit actually to an Ivy League school that I think has done a good job on this. And one of the reasons why we haven't seen as many issues at Dartmouth is because what they started doing pretty early on was they started having actual public dialogues between the pro-Palestinian and pro-Israel students before there was a major crisis, which, of course, is if you try to do this after the crisis, so good luck with that. But if you put do the hard work and groundwork in advance, you can create a situation where people are like, okay, oh, well, I definitely passionately disagree with you, but I don't necessarily think that everyone on your side is necessarily stupid or evil, which is you know, the starting point at which anybody going to higher ed should be at. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. And that, that meant that Dartmouth actually did a very smart thing by doing this work in advance. And I give them tremendous credit for it. And I have fingers crossed for Dartmouth continuing to innovate in that way. Yeah.